This is Judaism Unbound, episode 68, Rabbis Without Borders. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofus.
And we are here today with Rebecca Serbiu. She is the director of Rabbis Without Borders, a program of KLAL, the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. You'll recall that a few months ago we had Erwin Kula, one of the leaders of that organization, on a two-part episode of Judaism Unbound, which a lot of people really enjoyed. And so we're excited to have Rebecca here today to talk about a program of KLAL, Rabbis Without Borders, as well as the new website, rabbicareers.com, which was launched recently. It's a website that connects rabbis and jobs that need rabbis. And we might be surprised to know that this is a major innovation in the Jewish world, but it really is. And Rebecca is the impresario behind this website, and we're excited to talk about both programs today on the show. So Rebecca Serbiu, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's great to have you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's very exciting to be here.
So just to get started, I think it would be really helpful for our listeners to know a little bit about the organization that you run, Rabbis Without Borders. When I told my wife about it this morning, she said, that's not about providing rabbinical care to people in third world countries, is it?
No, it's not. No, so the idea of Rabbis Without Borders is to push the rabbis beyond their own borders. That's where the name comes from. We were founded 8 years ago with the idea that we wanted to gather together a very pluralistic group of rabbis. So rabbis spanning the entire Jewish denominational spectrum, and I would say post-denominational, since some rabbis don't affiliate with any denomination, and to introduce the rabbis to trends going on in America today, and then push them to share their Torah, meaning to use what they know from Jewish wisdom, put it out there in ways that can be accessible and meaningful to people, and put it out in the public square so that anybody, Jewish, non-Jewish, whoever that wants to access this Jewish wisdom can access it. And so that is the real thrust behind Rabbis Without Borders. We want to make Jewish wisdom accessible and meaningful to anybody. And in that process, we really want to, I would say, reinvent the rabbinate. We want to make people want to turn to rabbis for a variety of issues and concerns that they're dealing with in their lives.
Well, I mean, I was going to ask you, you know, and again, I understand we don't want to be disparaging, but at the same time, your organization is here to solve a problem, as any organization is, and or at least take advantage of an opportunity. And when you talked about the idea that this is about getting rabbis beyond their borders, I was just sort of wondering if you can give us a sense of a view of the rabbinate that the organization was coming into, saying, well, this is what's going on already, and these are the reasons why we think that there are opportunities here that an organization like this is really necessary for.
First of all, rabbis are educated very much still in a denominational system, you know, Reform, Conservative, Orthodox. And each of the schools have a particular viewpoint that they very much try to imprint on the rabbis that come through their schools. And we feel that some of this imprint tends to cut off creativity that rabbis might otherwise have within the rabbinate. So the first thing we wanted to do was create a very pluralist atmosphere, because that would help spur creativity if we put rabbis together from the different denominations so that they could speak to each other. Second, there is what we like to refer to as the narrative of erosion going on in the Jewish world, meaning we like to kind of beat our breasts and say, oy vey, nobody's coming to shul anymore, nobody's practicing Jewish ritual anymore. And a lot of rabbis are judging their successes in their rabbinates by these numerical markers, like how many people are coming for Shabbat, how many people are lighting Hanukkah candles, how many people are lighting Shabbat candles, how many people are observing Passover. And we firmly believe that these markers of whether or not that makes somebody Jewish are really not the right markers, and that rabbis are quickly getting, honestly, burned out in their rabbinates by judging themselves on these markers that really don't mean much, we believe, now in the Jewish world. You know, rabbis, I think, have to walk a very fine line. It is important that they serve the percentage that are still showing up. And I think there's some rabbis who do that extraordinarily well. And then there are those rabbis who really need to start thinking about what should we be doing differently to really speak to the needs that are out there. So that's some of what we see as the landscape that we want to address. And in addition to having denominational pluralism, I should say we also purposely attract a wide variety of kinds of rabbis. Only about 50% of the rabbis in Rabbis Without Borders have pulpits and are working in what would be considered a traditional pulpit situation. The other 50% are a wide mix. Some are in schools, some are chaplains, some are pursuing what we like to call independent rabbinates, meaning they're being entrepreneurial. They're founding new programs, they're founding new communities, they're doing things in completely different ways and being really experimental and innovative.
Do you find that rabbis who come to Rabbis Without Borders are people who, when they went to rabbinical school, they had a different sort of philosophy or a different set of goals than perhaps many of the other rabbis or students that were there, but they didn't have an option like this out there, so they chose the best that they could, but then in a way, this is really kind of who they were from the start? Or is it more that once they get out into the field, they have some kind of experience where they realize what I was taught in school isn't working or isn't right in some way, and then start looking for something else, and this is something that provides that something else?
Yeah, I think the answer is both and. I think in this... this network is both filled with people who from the get-go wanted, I would say, non-traditional rabbinate, wanted to pursue a different kind of rabbinate, wanted to be more experimental, wanted to find different ways of doing things. However, we also have a large group of people, I think, who, when they went to rabbinical school, loved what they studied in rabbinical school, loved what they encountered, and really, I'd say, bought in lock, stock, and barrel to whatever the messaging was that they received. And then they got out in the field. And in the field, they found that the interactions that they were having with individuals taught them something completely different than what they were taught in rabbinical school. They found that the nature of what they found themselves doing day to day was very different from what they expected. And many of them then, on their own accord, decided to start experimenting and looking for different ways of doing Jewish and being a leader within the Jewish community.
So first off, I want to say that I think it's great that Judaism Unbound and Rabbis Without Borders are meeting. Without Borders and Unbound makes a very clear statement that we really mean it. We want to push and think in new ways. So that's part one. Question, though, I'm curious to hear from you, I guess, like, why rabbis? So we've been talking about shifting forms of authority in the 21st century and how a lot of life is becoming sort of more open to whoever to exert their thoughts and authority. And so why Rabbis Without Borders in particular and not Rabbis and Cantors Without Borders? It could be Jewish Educators Without Borders. It could be Jews Without Borders. What is it about rabbis in particular that your organization sees particular potential in?
I think that's a really good question. And in fact, there was a lot of thought into that before we started. So Rabbis Without Borders is part of an organization named KLAL, the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. And in fact, an earlier kind of vision for this work, KLAL decided to bring together, let's call them like, they weren't all scholars, but kind of more Jewish wisdom people, scholarly type people to address these same kinds of issues. What they found, however, was that there wasn't the knowledge base that they expected, and there wasn't the facility to play with Jewish ritual in a way that a lot of rabbis are comfortable with. So that program was folded by KLAL, and the thought was, wow, well, let's try this, because honestly, a lot of what we do is an experiment, which I also find very freeing. We practice what we preach, right? We encourage the rabbis to experiment, and we ourselves experiment. So when we started this, it very much was an experiment to see, wow, if we take rabbis and try to deprogram them, right, from what they learned in rabbinical school, and then encourage them to think more creatively, will this indeed, A, have an impact on the rabbis themselves, and then B, will the rabbis themselves be able to have an impact out in the world on the congregants and the other people they're interacting with? And we found out very quickly that both proved to be true. You know, rabbis in the Jewish world have more basic Jewish education and knowledge than really almost everybody else. And so if we're talking about creating a group of Jewish leaders that can have a profound emotional impact on people, which really, when you want to create meaning, you want to create an emotional impact, We really think rabbis are the best suited to do so. So that's really why we went in that direction. And so far, thank God, we are seeing that to be the case.
Can you give us some examples of things that Rabbis Without Borders have done that are good examples of the aspirations that you have for how this program can work at its best, you know, and what does it look like when a rabbi with, you know, becomes without borders and starts doing things differently? And how does that inure to the benefit of those who are not connected? And how does that inure to the benefit of the existing institution that they're with?
So I guess I'll start with the more kind of quote unquote traditional pulpit rabbi. So for instance, I will reference Rabbi Rachel Gurovitz, who's now in Massachusetts. She came into her pulpit with a real goal and aim to, of course, not only minister to the people in her congregation, but to reach beyond it into her community. And she has fostered within her the larger community, not just her synagogue community, a number of different programs where she has interacted with people. So I know she did something with a beer tasting or a whiskey tasting. I think it was whiskey. She's into whiskey at a local bar, right? Not where you would expect to encounter your local rabbi. She actually taught a cooking class, you know, at a local cooking school, not affiliated with the JCC, right? We're just talking regular old cooking school in the community. Again, not a place you would think to encounter a rabbi. And in all of these places, she met people, Jews, non-Jews, people who began to see her as, you know, a religious figure, not just in her one congregation, but for the community as a whole. Another example of totally being very experimental is a rabbi named Dan Ain, who lives in Brooklyn, New York, who has founded something called Because Jewish. Right? It's just because. That's the answer. It's because it's Jewish. You want to do Jewish, come try it out. And the language of describing what he's doing is difficult. I would call it in some ways pop-up Judaism, although I would say that in and of itself is not a great way to describe it. But here's what he does, a variety of different kinds of things. So about once a month on Friday night, he has something called Korban Shabbat. So in Hebrew, Korban means sacrifice, which is kind of a strange thing to associate with Shabbat, except that Shabbat was traditionally the time when people would bring sacrifices to the temple in Jerusalem. And so he said, well, what would people, he created this service where the idea was people who were coming would offer something up, like one would offer sacrifice to the service, but in a very artsy way. So it is a service where a lot of people come to and people will literally offer a song, offer a dance, offer a poetry reading. And he creates a structure whereby there's a little bit of what we would consider traditional Jewish blessings in the beginning and in the end. But in the middle is literally the offerings of the people who are gathered. He does it in a different location every time. It's kind of off the beaten track. And that itself seems to have a certain cachet to it. Just one more example that is also just very interesting. We had one rabbi, Jeff Middleman, who created a new nonprofit called Sinai and Synapses. He's fascinated by the idea of the interplay between science and religion, right? A lot of what's in science and religion, they're asking the same questions, right? Who are we? Where did we come from? How did we get here? And there's a lot of division in modern American culture between the scientific world and the religious world. And so Jeff's goal is to try to have some conversations between the two. And also particularly in synagogues, where there are a lot of more scientifically minded people who won't step foot in a synagogue because they say, what is this? This doesn't mean anything to me. And he's created a whole nonprofit with a variety of different programs that foster conversations between these two groups and these two communities. It's not only between these two groups, but it's also interfaith and brings in Christian clergy and Buddhist, Baha'i, a number of different, and I think Muslim clergy as well, to have these conversations on a variety of levels and with a variety of people. So again, it's opening up access into talking about religion and God and all the big moral questions that we often ask ourselves in a very different way.
Could you define sort of for us what you mean, or what, not what you mean, but what one means by rabbi, right? Like as you're talking, right, I'm thinking in so many ways, so many thoughts are going through my mind, like what's the education for rabbis? What should it be? You know, in a way you're a kind of late intervention, you know, after the rabbis have been educated or miseducated for a long period of time, you know, I mean, that are there, you know, is it the case, not so much that rabbis are being miseducated, because that's a value-laden statement, they're maybe properly educated to serve a small and shrinking percentage of the Jewish population, there may be a whole nother part of the Jewish population that desperately needs rabbis, but that would need to be trained differently in some way, including, not least of which, as I'm listening to all this, it strikes me, you know, a less expensive form of training so that they wouldn't need to make so much money on the other end of it just to pay back their loans. You know, I just want to say, because I think a lot of the time on our show, we tend to be thinking about people who maybe aren't looking for rabbis, right? But I do really think that there's a large group of people who are looking for rabbis, who do want religion, who do want spirituality, even rather classically understood, but don't necessarily need a lot of the things that the seminaries seem to really focus on, and that there's a real mismatch between the rabbinical education and the need out there.
Yes. Okay, well, there was a lot in there that you just asked, Dan. Let's see if I can try to break it down a little bit. So, one, yes, I think there is a mismatch happening right now between rabbinical education and what people out in the world need. And that is some of what, you're right, we are a quote-unquote late intervention to address. And my hope is that as time goes on, it can be addressed earlier in the process. And hopefully we would be involved in addressing it earlier in the process. And we will evolve as need be. Your question that you started out with, I think, is a really fascinating one. What defines a rabbi today? There are a variety of ways to answer that question. Really, I think a rabbi is often defined by if there is a group of people who sees that person as a religious figure and leader and listens to their teaching. And that is a lot of what is sometimes happening today. And sometimes that happens with people who traditionally hold the title rabbi and have been given ordination from a brick and mortar seminary. And sometimes not. And so there's a lot of, I would say, anxiety in the traditional system right now, because there are now a variety of ways of even becoming a rabbi. There are the traditional denominational brick and mortar seminaries. There are now some pluralist seminaries that are out there. There are also some online seminaries where somebody can study for a year or two and then get ordination and call themselves a rabbi. This is very threatening to many in the, let's call them the brick and mortar seminary world. But they are doing a lot of what you're alluding to. There are people who are becoming ordained as rabbis at a much cheaper cost, both financially and time-wise, and are going out and in some cases really adequately serving a group of people as a rabbi. At Rabbis Without Borders, I would say for us, we don't define who a rabbi is. If somebody applies to become part of our fellowship and our network, we take them on face value. We have a very highly competitive application process. We have about 100 rabbis a year who apply for 20 spots. So if you make it through our application process and are admitted, then you're admitted. And we do not question someone's ordination. But it's a great question. How to define a rabbi? I think we're really at a point in time in America today where that question is a very much a live one, and the definition is shifting underneath our feet.
I'm thinking about Shai Cohen's article called The Significance of Yavne, Professor Shai Cohen of Harvard. And it was one of these articles that talked about who were the early rabbis. In Yavne, in the academy where they sort of put together the early forms of rabbinic Judaism. And, you know, his question was, were they Pharisees? Were they Sadducees? Were they Essenes? Were they, you know, these various sects that existed at the time of the Second Temple? And ultimately, he concludes they were Pharisees, but they didn't like to call themselves that. You know, right? Meaning they realized that they were in a time where it was no longer valuable to call yourself a Pharisee, in part because we'd like to include some Sadducees if they would be interested, right? You know, and so this is like where I'm kind of struggling to think through this question of, you know, what future are we building toward, and what will be the criteria? You know, Lex and I have talked in the past about this idea of the chutzpah versus knowledge curve, you know, that we want people with chutzpah and knowledge, you know, and in a sense, I think one of the realities is that if you're a person who wants to gain a lot of Jewish knowledge today, and you don't want to be an academic, you don't have a lot of choices. A lot of those people go to rabbinical school and they end up as rabbis, but they're not necessarily, some of them aren't rabbis because they have a spiritual desire or skills, right? They just wanted the education. Some people do have a lot of spiritual goals and abilities, and you know, they're all called rabbis, you know, and so what do we do with that?
There are a couple of ways to approach this. One is, what's the special value add-on of being a rabbi? Well, we're living within the larger American culture, and American culture has always given religious leaders a particular platform, I would say, or a particular higher calling, right? Priests, ministers, preachers, right, have always had, I would say, maybe even you want to call it mythological power in the American culture and narrative. And so I think rabbis still very much hold that power. And so having the title and being a quote unquote officially ordained as a rabbi does give a certain standing in American society and immediately gives a certain understanding for the person approaching the rabbi that this is hopefully, and we can get into why it's not always the case, but hopefully someone who has a certain knowledge, a certain spiritual understanding, a certain facility as a leader, right? And it has all of those connotations, which I think are important. At the same time, I think we're all also aware that right now there is a large undermining of authority figures in American culture. And so unfortunately, all religious authority figures are being drawn into that as well. And so there is an undermining going on of priests and ministers and rabbis and imams and a general sense of distrust for anybody who's an authority figure, let alone a religious authority figure, because religion, I think, has been really misused in the public culture in the past, however, 20, 30, 40 years. In which case, I would say having the title rabbi could definitely be a detriment rather than a value add-on. So it can be looked at, I think, in both of those ways. In terms of your question of what are we building for the future, I guess in some ways it's still very much an open question, but given the structures that we have right now, I still have belief that someone who has the title rabbi, given that that person's really aware of their role, their title, how they use their knowledge in the world, is important. You said it yourself, and that many people still seek out, I'm going to use the word spiritual leaders, or if not religious leaders, and I think there's a bit of a difference there, but let's use the word spiritual leaders. When it's been my personal experience, when someone who has not traditionally seen themselves as religious or spiritual hits a bump in the road, right? They are diagnosed with an illness, someone they love is diagnosed with an illness, somebody dies, they're struggling being parents, whatever the bump in the road is, people turn to those who they think have wisdom, to those who they think can help them. And my goal here is to create, I would say, a rabbinic class or a rabbinate that people would honestly want to turn towards and see rabbis as a font of wisdom that, wow, maybe this person has something that they can share with me. Maybe there is something in that 1,000-year-old tradition of real value. Gosh, there must be a reason why it's stuck around this long. And I'm going to trust that rabbi to reinterpret it for me in a way that I can use in my life.
Yeah, I want to throw in, because somebody who's currently in rabbinical school, I can say just like literally the day, like within days of me posting on Facebook that I was starting rabbinical school. So like I was the same human,
right?
But like within days, and since then, people have been, you know, contacting me with questions and various kinds of conversations that they want to have that they were happening before because people knew me as somebody, but not anywhere near as much. And it's sheerly because I'm, you know, in this process called rabbinical school, because it really was sort of like flipping a coin, a shift happened. And I'm not sure if that's good or not. I actually think it might not be, because I think it'd be great if we sort of, I'm thinking about what we discussed before, this shift in authority. I actually think I mostly am psyched about that, because with the undermining of a small group of traditionally recognized authority figures, we have sort of, I don't know, overmining is not a word, but an elevating of all sorts of other people who previously wouldn't have been seen that way. But I do think at the same time, it's clear that there still is a need, based on these conversations that started, for people that sort of label themselves, hi, I'm a Jewish version of religious, spiritual, some sort of guidance, come to me.
What could we view in the future that would really be the rabbinical program, training program, and how to be a rabbi that we really need for, as you see it?
You know, we have talked a lot in our office about the idea of opening a rabbinical school. It's a big idea. It's a complicated idea. And I also think it's an attainable and achievable idea. So, you know, as of yet, we haven't gone there. Because I think there's still so much work to be done with the rabbis who have gone through the existing rabbinical schools. And so, you know, as with anything, you have to keep your mission focused. So right now, our mission is focused on those who are already out in the rabbinate. We do, however, teach quite often in all of the existing rabbinical schools. And we used to have a fellowship program specifically geared at rabbinical school students. We folded that mainly because we found that it was frustrating for students, right? They'd be getting these very different messages from us than what they were getting in school. And they also didn't have the ability to start experimenting and playing with what they were learning right away, the way that rabbis in pulpits or out in the field could do immediately. So we pulled back from that a little bit. Look, in terms of the future and the big picture, I would love for every rabbi to be a rabbi without borders. But that said, I'm also a pluralist, and I also believe that that's not possible. It's not who every rabbi is. You know, I now have had the great fortune to be able to teach rabbis without borders and to be able to teach rabbinic groups in a variety of different kinds of settings. And there are some rabbis, they think differently. And I want to say that really without any judgment attached. You know, they honestly embrace and love the borders that they have been educated within and practice their rabbinates within. Like you, I do believe there's really space for that right now, because we're at a time of transition in the Jewish world. And when you're in times of transition, there needs to be lots and lots of options. So I like the option of both your kind of bordered rabbi and your unbordered rabbi. And I think for the next, I don't know, 10, 20 years, that's what we have to have out there. And we are going to have to see. People are going to tell us. We're going to know. Right. What is going to be more appealing, and how to, at least from my end, how to train rabbis to respond to those days. I mean, and that's our goal.
There's a few things you mentioned that got me thinking and excited, because we've talked a little bit about disconnects between rabbinical schools and then what happens in the field. And we've also mentioned sort of the pulpit versus other rabbis doing organizational work or whatever they're doing. And I think that there's a really important disconnect that we haven't quite talked about yet. And I experience it as somebody who's currently in rabbinical school. Love my rabbinical school, but it's something that frustrates me. Our default for what a rabbi is pulpit.
Yes, yes.
We think of, okay, a rabbi is sort of synagogue normally. And then sure, there are others. We're all aware of those, but like definitely the default is synagogue. And in everything from anecdotal conversations to, you know, people asking, oh, so I mentioned I'm in rabbinical school. Oh, like, are there renewal congregations that you, well, there are. It's not what I'm looking to do. And it's not what many of my classmates are looking to do. And it's not, and more than that, many of those, the number of those in the country are shrinking, in terms of rabbinic positions and numbers of synagogues. So I'm curious if we can talk a little bit more about, for folks who might not be aware, what rabbis are doing, that isn't necessarily the synagogue focus, both, by the way, people who are in official, quote unquote, rabbinic roles. So they're rabbis working for a Jewish organization, whatever. And, you know, more and more we're seeing people who are rabbis, but are doing whatever they're doing. I know that one of the folks who writes on your blog frequently and who was a guest on our show, David Marcus, he's a judge and is a rabbi also. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that sort of shift.
Thank you for asking this question. I love it. So I myself have never been in a pulpit in my entire rabbinate. I worked at a Jewish community center for 7 years. I worked as a chaplain for a year and a half, and I'm working now here, you know, as director of Rabbis Without Borders. And if I had a dollar for every time people say, oh, so you're not really a rabbi because I don't have a synagogue, I would be quite a rich woman. And I also see as part of my personal goal is to educate people that rabbi does not mean pulpit. Rabbi does not mean synagogue, that there is just a really vast array of things a rabbi can do and does do. And in fact, I've heard a statistic, I'm not sure exactly where it came from, that about 50% of the active rabbinate is now not in the pulpit. And in fact, from some of the other work that I've been doing in terms of helping rabbis find jobs, I think there's actually much more growth in the non-pulpit area of the rabbinate than in the pulpit area. Because many pulpits, as you mentioned, are shrinking, are closing, are merging. And so there are other places for rabbis to fill their careers. So what are rabbis doing outside of the pulpit? Well, they're the simple thing, not simple. There are some things that immediately come to mind, which won't surprise anybody, such as, you know, teaching in day schools or running Jewish day schools, running Hebrew schools, being somewhere in the educational sphere, because, you know, rabbis are learned people and they're teachers. And so that would make a lot of sense. Another sphere is the chaplaincy sphere, working in hospitals, nursing homes, in the military. There are many rabbis and a growing number of rabbis doing that kind of work. And I also think that's going to be a growth area in the rabbinate, particularly as the baby boomer population begins to age. There is a huge need for, I think, spiritual leaders to help people both do life reviews and navigate end of life type questions and situations. There's then a number of rabbis now working in the nonprofit world, more and more. This, I think, is also a growing area, some within Jewish organizations, for instance, the social justice world. There are many nonprofits that have been founded just within the past, I would say, 10 to 15 years in the Jewish social justice world. Truah comes to mind, Avodah, Bend the Ark. AJWS, American Jewish World Service. There are rabbis working in all of those organizations. There are also rabbis working in non-Jewish nonprofits. You might be surprised to learn that a lot of regional Planned Parenthood offices have clergy attached to them to do education and outreach. Some of those are Christian clergy, but I also know rabbis who are working, for instance, for Planned Parenthood as, you know, a nonprofit organization. So I personally find it really exciting what's happening outside of the pulpit world for rabbis. I think there is a rich variety. And when somebody says to me, oh, that's not rabbinic work, I say, why not? I think any rabbi who approaches their work from the mindset of I am a spiritual leader doing this work and I am going to bring the wisdom of my tradition to the work that I am doing, that is a rabbinic position. And that can happen anywhere in any kind of environment.
One piece I've been itching to ask you about is that there was this article recently featuring you talking about a new initiative that you're leading called rabbicareers.com. And yeah, I'd love to hear what that's all about and how it either does or doesn't dovetail with the other work that you've already mentioned.
I am so excited about rabbicareers.com, which just launched in the fall of 2016. So in my position of director of Rabbis Without Borders, over the past few years, my phone has started ringing fairly regularly from both congregations and nonprofits and other types of places, with people calling saying, hi, Rebecca, I've heard about Rabbis Without Borders. I've heard you have this group of really talented, creative rabbis. We're looking for a rabbi. Can you help connect us with somebody? And I would say, sure, tell me what you're looking for. And they would go through their spiel of what they're looking for. And in some cases, I was able to make connections. In other cases, I would make referrals. And sometimes I wouldn't be able to help. But last year, my phone started ringing more. Partly because we also got a grant to send rabbis to underserved Jewish populations. So, for instance, you know, there are a bunch of communities in the Rust Belt and in the South where there are these old, small Jewish communities, and they have no access to a rabbi. And we got a grant to be able to send some of our Rabbis Without Borders out to these communities. And we did publicity around this. And what happened was that I got a bunch of calls from small congregations across the country who said, "Hi, I heard about this service corps that you started sending rabbis to us. You know, we don't really need a volunteer rabbi. We've been trying in some cases for years to hire a rabbi, but we're not members of any affiliated denomination, and they're not helping us find a rabbi, and we're having a really hard time finding a rabbi. Can you help us?" And of course, my goal here is to serve people. I said, "Yes, let me see what I can do." And at that point in time, it became clear to me I could not serve all these people out of the network of 200 rabbis that I have for Rabbis Without Borders. And it was like that light bulb moment where I went, wait a minute, we need a clearinghouse so that rabbis can find jobs and employers can find rabbis. That does not exist currently in the Jewish world. And there are all these websites now where people go to find jobs, Idealist and Monster and, you know, even JewishJobs.com. And Jewish Jobs sometimes post jobs that are applicable for rabbis, but most of what's on Jewish Jobs is not. So I had this big brainstorm and I said, let's do it. And so I created this website called rabbicareers.com. And the goal is to connect anybody, both in the pulpit and the non-pulpit worlds, who's looking for a rabbi. They are free to post a job for free on the website. And any rabbi, and in fact, we had cantors as well, can go onto the site, register as a user, and look at the jobs and apply. In addition, the rabbis can also choose to post their resumes and say, hey, this is who I am. Are you looking for me? So that it goes both ways, with employers being able to check out rabbis, rabbis being able to check out employers. And, you know, we're beginning to make matches between the two. And as I said, it's any possible rabbinic job, both in the pulpit and outside of the pulpit.
You know, early on in our podcast series, we had Barak Richman on our show, and he talked a lot at that time about his frustrations as a member of a search committee for his synagogue, which was a conservative synagogue that was restricted by the rules of the conservative movement to only being able to look at conservative ordained rabbis, or at least rabbis who are currently members of the conservative rabbi group. You know, that was a rule of being affiliated with the conservative movement. And Barak at that time found that very frustrating. And as a law professor, he actually felt it was illegal. And he thought of that as a, you know, basically an illegal relationship between a cartel and a kind of group of you know, representing the employees in restraint of trade, and that's really illegal in the world. Now, whether it's illegal or not, to me, is less the issue. But, you know, I was on a search committee, too, and my fellow members of the committee had a very hard time wrapping their minds around this. You know, like, they just didn't get it. You know, they were just like, I don't understand why we can't just hire any rabbi that we would think would be a good rabbi for our synagogue. I understood it. You know, it makes sense that if you're saying we're part of a ideological movement, you know, that we train the leaders who carry our ideology, and, you know, that we would make sense that only leaders from this training would be leaders of synagogues within this movement. I think that the reason why this is so puzzling to people is actually because the people, for the most part, have transcended the movements, right? That the people don't buy this whole movement thing. Yeah, they think of themselves as reform or conservative, but they really don't have any idea what that means practically. They don't think it's all that important. So if I'm a reform synagogue and a conservative rabbi comes along who seems really great and who, you know, basically is willing to abide by our congregation's practices, then what's the big deal, right? They're not ideological in the way that I think the movements either imagined that they were in the past or they actually were in the past. That's something we could talk about. I don't actually think that's true that they ever were. But in any event, I guess what it strikes me as the discovery that you're making is that the people already are without borders. So it strikes me that what's going on is that we have these synagogues that are without borders, and you're doing this work to sort of create a class of rabbis that are without borders. But because of the structure of the denominations, which is the way that the synagogue world is mostly set up right now, there's no mechanism for the synagogues without borders to meet the rabbis without borders and to be able to hire them without running afoul of the rules and regulations of their movement. So I guess the question is, like, what's the next step that addresses that problem? Because, you know, our synagogue, even if this website existed when we were doing our search a few years ago, I don't know what we would have been able to do, because I think that the conservative movement would have said that we're not allowed to use it. Is that right?
So I just want to make clear some of the things you did already say, and then I'll move on to answering. Yes, there are very clear movement rules which synagogues who are affiliated with the movement need to abide by, which dictate who can apply to be the rabbi of particular synagogues. It depends how many years you've been out of school and all of that kind of stuff. We created this website to serve the needs of people. And as you said, some of the needs of the people of these congregations have moved beyond movement structures. At the same time, more and more congregations are also unaffiliating from the movements for a variety of reasons. A lot of it does happen to be financial, because there's a financial cost to affiliating with the movement, and they're having a hard time finding rabbis. So again, we wanted to serve this need. And I just want to be really clear. Our goal is to serve the existing needs of congregations and people out there. We are not looking and by any means to undermine the movement system. That said, you know, and we clearly state on the form that we ask people to fill out to post a job, you know, it please abide by the rules of your particular movement. But it is very much up to the individual community how they choose to do that. If they decide to abide by movement rules or don't abide by movement rules, it's been very interesting. I will share the website's been up now several months, and I've gotten a lot of questions from movement affiliated congregations about posting, and people are struggling with this. People are struggling with it. They want, as you said, the best rabbi they can find. And I know that they are having conversations with some of the placement directors of the movements to see if there's a way that they can do both. And so, again, I want to be clear that I've been very careful not to step on movement toes. And I've encouraged people to be really upfront with their movements about what they need so that the movements can continue to serve them. But there are people who are very much saying, wow, maybe this is a way to go too. I believe the landscape is shifting. It's been shifting for quite a while, and it's going to continue to shift. We see this within the larger American cultural sphere as well, where non-denominational churches are on the upswing, right? Even in the Christian world, there's a trend towards non-denominationalism or post-denominationalism, whatever word you feel more comfortable using. So I think that, you know, the Jewish world is following that trend where people, you know, I'm just Jewish, right? They don't care to attach themselves to a larger structure, and that, in fact, the larger structures aren't serving their needs in a direct way.
Well, that's what I'm sort of wondering about. You know, it's really just whether what you're doing, both with Rabbis Without Borders and RabbiCareers.com, is recognizing a reality that you did not bring about, you know, and that the many of the existing players, for absolutely natural institutional reasons, and this is what we've been trying to focus on throughout the length of this podcast series, is the idea that institutions behave in predictable ways, not because there's anything wrong with them, but because they're actually functioning properly as institutions. But there are certain times that come about that put pressure on institutions that have been around a long time, because when the change is large enough, the way that they've been functioning doesn't work anymore. But because they're institutions, they are often simply unable to shift gears in the way that the gears need to be shifted, because, like you said earlier, there are people who do like what they're doing. You know, if they didn't have anybody who liked what they were doing, of course they would shift immediately. The problem is when you've hit rock bottom, it's actually good, because then you're willing to shift. You know, if you haven't hit rock bottom, your hands are tied in many ways, and I think that in many ways describes what we're seeing in the Jewish world. And if nobody like you comes along, then you can kind of keep coasting by and hope that somehow the problem will go away. It won't go away, and you'll actually end up going kaput, but you can at least hope for a while that it's going to be okay. So in a way, it seems to me like what you've done is come along and said, well, you know, that's not what the Jews out there need, you know, and so we're going to at least try to start working to accept the reality that we see and to start working in the ways that we can to try to connect rabbis with ideas that they're not finding elsewhere, and then to connect congregations and organizations with rabbis that share those ideas. I think it's really exciting.
Thank you so much. You summarized that really well.
All right. Well, make sure there's a kickback for any fundraising success.
You got it. I'm putting you on our website.
I just want to say for all of our listeners that Rabbis Without Borders came into existence 8 years ago. Borders, the bookstore, went out of business in 2011. So they clearly can take credit for ridding the world of at least one border. So we can tell that this is an organization that's succeeding and worth following. But any other final thoughts you have to give to our listeners before we close?
Oh, thank you. That's really a funny comparison that you made. Look, I guess my final thought is I want to be clear that, you know, what exists right now with Rabbis Without Borders is simply a bridge to whatever is coming next in the Jewish world. And we are helping to construct that bridge as we are constantly learning, both from the rabbis that we're working with and from congregants who we all speak to on a regular basis. And so together we're constructing the bridge from where we are today with the denominations, with the borders that do exist, to what may be in the future. And we are not pretending to have a clear vision about what the future holds. I mean, what may happen over the next 4 years is certainly going to be different from what has been happening in the past 4 years in this country. So I could not sit here and presume to tell you, you know, what the needs are necessarily going to be 4 years from now. What I do hope is that we're creating a rabbinate that is going to be nimble enough to use Jewish wisdom in a way that can respond to those needs as they come up.
So thanks so much, Rebecca. It was great having you on Judaism Unbound.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a really wonderful conversation, and I feel very honored to have been your guest today.
And it was really an honor to have you. We hope that all of you out there listening enjoyed this boundaryless and without borders conversation. I swear, with those kinds of names, we must be eliminating dozens of barriers by the minute. I mean, no boundaries, no borders. This is a good world we're creating. But we want you to help create it with us, and you can do that by being in touch with us. So please, please do so. There's a few ways for you to do that. One is to hit us up on our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. You can also head to our website, judaismunbound.com. And the last way for you to be in touch with us is via email, which you can do at dan@nextjewishfuture.org or lex@nextjewishfuture.org. The last request we always like to make is that you support us financially if you're able, and you can do that at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening, and with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.